for Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. Right-wing youth leader Charlie Kirk's assassination is once again raising the alarm on political violence in the U.S. We'll have the latest. And Israel's strike on Hamas leaders in Qatar may have far-reaching consequences for conflict resolution in the Middle East. Plus, tonight the Emmys will celebrate the best in TV, but NPR's critic at large, Eric Deggans, has his own awards to give out before the big show.
I looked over their nominations, I tossed in a little snark, my own critical observations, and voila, you have a Deggie Award.
It's Sunday, September 14th. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with a special edition of the Up North Report. When Rob Warsham interviewed for his internship, he was asked, "Are you comfortable walking in the middle of 60 black bears?"
I'm retired Army, and I've been in some interesting places, and I was like, sure, why not? 60, I didn't think, you know, that big a deal.
Warsham's now been with the Vince Shooty Wildlife Sanctuary for almost a month.
There's nothing like standing in a crowd of 100 black bears and go, oh my.
The nonprofit American Bear Association runs the sanctuary, which is 10 miles northwest of Orr as the crow flies. There, interns like Rob, volunteers, and a handful of staff feed the bears.
We try to kind of feed them a natural diet. It's just dried fruits, nuts, seed, to complement what they're already going to eat out there in the wild.
Steph Horner is the president and executive director.
There's not fences, there's not cages, they're coming and going as they please, some more than others.
The meals looked a little different when the feeding first started decades ago. Vince Shooty was a logger, and he and his men often dealt with black bears breaking into their camp. After 3 decades of shooting and killing the nuisance bears, he tried something else.
He was like, gosh, they seem to really like my sourdough pancakes, so maybe I should just make them a separate batch. I'll place it away from the cabins and see what happens.
It worked in that it stopped the break-ins. Horner says the troubles of feeding wildlife weren't really known at the time.
Once bears learn a food source, they don't forget a food source, so they continued to come back. I like to say, you know, it wasn't, sure, it wasn't right, but Vince was ahead of his time. He was trying to peacefully coexist with the wildlife that he was sharing a home with.
More and more people came to visit, feeding the bears junk food and trash.
People were doing crazy things like putting kids on the bears' backs and stuff like that. And so not only were there fears of people getting hurt, but it was super disrespectful to the bears.
The nonprofit began in 1995 and built the first deck for visitors to observe from. 10 to 15,000 people visit each year between Memorial Day and Labor Day. Their admissions, plus a gift shop and photography workshops, fund the sanctuary's work. Horner acknowledges that feeding the bears is no longer best practice, and continuing to do so is controversial. In nearby Net Lake, Boys Fort band members have expressed concern that the practice is making the bears too comfortable around humans, leading to potential conflict. Horner says there's concerns that if feeding stopped, it could lead to even more conflict. Tourists who come to surrounding resorts aren't bear aware, and their poor practices could cause problems for suddenly hungry bears.
But, you know, this is a great opportunity for people to learn about bears and to learn how to be bear aware. So we pride ourselves in being a facility that teaches that.
She says that's why the sanctuary's work is important.
The more people that you teach about them, they're going to learn and understand the animal. They're going to ultimately care more about that animal.
The internship program is another education element. The sanctuary gets 15 to 30 interns throughout the season. Ava Stark graduated from UCLA in the spring with a bachelor's in ecology, behavior, and evolution. Thursday was her last day. She says the highlight was witnessing the magic of bear behavior.
Because I really am interested in wildlife behavior and wildlife conservation, and just the work they do here is great.
With Stark's departure, Warsham is the final intern of the season. He'll be there until the last bear leaves to hibernate. The 56-year-old from Pennsylvania isn't your typical intern, but he was bad at retirement. He's pursuing a wildlife rehab certificate and needed the experience. He also loves the bear behavior.
It's kind of special to see and learn. Yeah, two cubs pretending to be adults going. Because I've been watching just this last week alone, the cubs are practicing adulting.
Despite its history, the sanctuary isn't very well known. Horner says it relies heavily on word of mouth.
I would love to scream it at the top of my lungs and for everybody to know about us.
The Vince Schuette Wildlife Sanctuary is always looking for volunteers, she says, and reopens to visitors again Memorial Day weekend. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
In addition from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning, and thank you for joining us today. The assassination of right-wing youth leader Charlie Kirk last week has once again shifted focus onto political violence and the increasing polarization in American society. Here's Utah's Republican Governor Spencer Cox speaking to the press on Friday.
To my young friends out there, you are inheriting a country where politics feels like rage. It feels like rage is the only option. But through those words, we have a reminder that we can choose a different path.
We're now joined by NPR senior national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Good morning, Mara.
Good morning, Aisha.
So, you know, it was exactly 3 months ago that we were talking about the assassination of Minnesota State Democratic Representative Melissa Hortman, who was shot and killed in her home along with her husband. Her fellow Democratic lawmaker, Senator John Hoffman, and his wife were also targeted. They survived the assassination attempt. And now here we are again talking about another assassination.
That's right. There have been so many acts of political violence recently. The two assassination attempts against President Trump, the attack on Nancy Pelosi's husband, the shooting of House Republican Steve Scalise, the pardoning of the January 6th violent offenders, where Trump sent the message that political violence conducted on his behalf is okay. And the fact is that polls show that political violence is becoming more acceptable among the public. There was a PBS Marist NPR poll that showed 1 in 5 Americans said political violence may be justified in some circumstances. Republicans were a little more likely to agree with that statement than Democrats, 28% of Republicans, 12% of Democrats. And the way people look at their political opponents in the United States has become very apocalyptic. The other party isn't just someone you disagree with, but if they got elected, America would be destroyed. And you've seen other polls among college students. Recently, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression found that 34% of college students in the U.S. approved of using violence to stop a campus speech. And that's exactly what happened with Charlie Kirk's assassination.
Usually when there are acts of political violence, we depend on our leaders to try to tamp this down, to try to bring us together. Is that what's happening now?
Well, it certainly is happening with the Utah governor, Spencer Cox. You just played that bite from him. But not so much from President Trump. He dedicated a 4-minute address to Charlie Kirk on Wednesday night. He held what he called the, quote, radical left responsible for Kirk's assassination. He promised that his administration would find, quote, each and every one of those who contributed to this atrocity, even though the ideological motives of the alleged assassin are still unknown. But Spencer Cox has been trying to tamp down the rage. He said one person is responsible for this.
So how is this divisive, maybe even, you know, acrimonious vibe going to spill over to other things like, you know, a possible government shutdown if Congress can't pass the federal budget?
Well, it's hard to imagine Congress being any more divisive and polarized than it already is. Even after Charlie Kirk's death, there was a shouting match on the floor of the House. But you're right. Congress is facing the possibility of a government shutdown if they don't pass a budget or a continuing resolution by September 30th. And the only way that Congress can keep the government open is with a bipartisan vote in the Senate. There are just not enough Republicans to overcome a filibuster. And that means the pressure is on Democrats on whether they're going to agree to keep the government open, to give the Republicans the votes they need, as they have in the past. And there's now a big part of the Democratic base that wants its leaders to fight, to refuse to provide votes to keep the government open. They say this is Democrats' only leverage to get concessions on Medicaid cuts or Obamacare subsidies. But then there are other Democrats who say Donald Trump and the Republicans don't want the government to stay open. Why should Democrats play into their hands? So this is a very fraught issue for Democrats who aren't quite sure who would benefit politically from a government shutdown.
I mean, so there's a lot going on domestically, but President Trump is heading to the UK this week for a state visit. What do we know about this trip?
Well, we know that he is the first American president to get two state visits to the United Kingdom. This is a very fraught moment for Europe. Russia has attacked a NATO member, Poland, with a 12-hour massive drone attack that Europe has condemned. Trump has not, at least not yet. He said it could have been a mistake. But even though other American officials have said the U.S. stands with NATO and our treaty commitments are intact, Trump seems to be giving, once again, Vladimir Putin the benefit of the doubt.
That's NPR's Mara Liasson. Thank you, Mara.
You're welcome.
Qatar, a close U.S. ally, has become one of the most important mediators in the Middle East, most recently assisting efforts to try to negotiate an end to the war in Gaza between Israel and Hamas. In 2011, the United States requested that Qatar host the Hamas leadership, provide a base for the group as a way to make communicating with the group easier. Last week, Israel targeted Hamas leadership in the capital, Doha, by bombing a building there in broad daylight. To understand what this means for the current Gaza ceasefire negotiations and the role of Qatar as a mediator, we turn to Khalid El-Gindi. He's a visiting scholar at the Georgetown Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
There are real ceasefire negotiations on the table right now, mediated by Qatar, to end the war in Gaza. The U.S. said it got very little warning that Israel was going to strike Qatar. What are the implications of this attack?
I think the ceasefire talks are effectively dead now, at least for the foreseeable future. There are wide-reaching implications for America's allies, but also other Arab Gulf states and other allies in the region are going to be asking themselves, what does it mean to have American security guarantees if they're going to allow an attack like this to happen?
Well, why does Israel want to kill Hamas leadership when it's supposed to be negotiating with them?
That's the million-dollar question. The attack confirms that Israel is not serious about a ceasefire deal, that it is not a priority to get its hostages released, and that it is much more interested in pursuing an agenda that is based on the annihilation of Gaza.
Qatar is going to hold an emergency meeting with Arab states to address the attack on Doha. Egypt is the other mediator in the Gaza ceasefire talks. How are Arab countries likely to react after this attack?
I think we're going to see very strong language, not only in solidarity with Qatar and its sovereignty, but also some anger directed at the United States as well. The United States did not do itself any favors by allowing this attack to happen. I don't think very many people accept the claim that Donald Trump only had a few minutes warning or not very much advance notification. And that gives, I think, Washington's Arab allies a sense that they greenlit this attack, which will really, really give them pause.
Well, stepping back, why did the U.S. ask Qatar to host the Hamas leadership back in 2011? I mean, this is a group that the U.S. has designated a terrorist organization.
Right. Well, it's precisely because of that that the U.S. asked Qatar to play that role, because they couldn't. There is an understanding that Hamas is an actor. Simply putting it on the list of terrorist organizations doesn't negate its existence.
Do you think Qatar will now reevaluate this role after the attack?
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, they've said as much, that they're suspending the ceasefire talks. I mean, why wouldn't they? You know, in their mind, they were operating on the assumption that all parties were acting in good faith. But when one of the parties tries to kill the negotiators of the other side in the host country that is mediating between them, it really calls into question the seriousness of that process.
Well, if mediators like Qatar give up these roles because they no longer feel safe, what does it mean for the war in Gaza and conflicts in the world generally? And is there another country that could step into this role?
So one scenario is, you know, Egypt steps up its role as a go-between, you know, as a party that can talk to all sides. But of course, they will look at what happened in Qatar and say, could the same thing happen here in Cairo? And based on the very blustery rhetoric from Netanyahu, who insists that they will go after Hamas anywhere and everywhere, regardless, they will also kind of be given some pause.
So that's obviously the war in Gaza. I mean, do you think that this has ramifications for these sorts of conflicts in the world generally?
I think so. I mean, Israel has rewritten the rules, such as they are, of warfare, of diplomacy, I mean, essentially by shattering them. And I think it, you know, would not surprise me to see other major powers kind of adopting the Israeli model of, well, you know, who says we can't kill the people we're sitting across the table from? I think a lot of countries like Russia or China might look at this model and say, the international rules-based order that we used to speak of really no longer exists. It's really a world where anything goes, and so I can probably get away with the same kinds of things.
That's Khalid El-Gindi, visiting scholar at the Georgetown Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition this Sunday morning here on member-supported KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. And now a message paid for by the Minnesota Department of Health. Sometimes you just need to talk about it, but it can be hard to find someone who really listens. That's why there is 988, with support that meets you where you are. Confidential and staffed by trained folks who want to help when you need someone to talk to. Call or text 988 or chat online at 988lifeline.org. Happy Dancing Turtle in Pine River invites you to their garden Thursday, September 18th from 1 to 4. Learn about seasonal strategies, hoop houses, and more. Support for KAXE comes from the 17th Annual Community Connect, Thursday, September 18th from 11 to 3 at Yanmar Arena in Grand Rapids, featuring over 50 social service agencies providing information on housing, energy, county assistance, and more. All are welcome. More info can be found by dialing 211.
I'm Dwahli Saikautau with these headlines. A British government-run program has evacuated its first group of critically ill and injured Palestinian children to receive medical care in the United Kingdom. They've left Gaza and are expected this week in the UK, according to British media. At least 30 people across the country have been either put on leave, fired, investigated, or face calls to resign because of social media posts reacting to the murder of Charlie Kirk. And a demonstration in London led by far-right activist Tommy Robinson attracted more than 110,000 people. Some 24 were arrested when police and protesters clashed yesterday. I'm Dwahli Sykautel, NPR News in New York City.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Dickinson College, awarding the Rose Walters Prize for Global Environmental Activism to combat climate change and inspire future leaders. Learn more at dickinson.edu/RWP. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. The conservative activist Charlie Kirk was assassinated Wednesday while speaking at Utah Valley University. Authorities say the sniper fired a single shot from a rooftop about 150 yards away. On Friday, a suspect, 22-year-old Tyler Robinson, was taken into custody. Kirk's death has prompted questions about how vulnerable public figures are to violence and what can be done about that, especially at outdoor events. NPR's Meg Anderson joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the typical or what is typical in securing an outdoor event like this?
Yeah, so there were about 3,000 people at this particular event. It was held in sort of a quad. The university's police chief said Wednesday they had about 6 officers working the event. Kirk had his own private security team as well. But security experts I spoke to said that number of officers was not enough for an event of this size. Given those limited resources, they said security would typically be focused on threats in close proximity. You know, someone rushing the stage with a handgun or a knife. What ended up happening was obviously different, and more officers on the ground, you know, maybe wouldn't have prevented that. But I should say, we don't know exactly what the security plan was. I reached out to the university. I have not heard back.
What would have to happen to keep someone safe from a sniper attack like this?
Yeah, so pre-planning is important. You know, checking out an event space ahead of time to look for vulnerabilities. It's unclear if that happened. Kirk was essentially sitting in a bowl, a low point with a lot of tall buildings around him. That was a big vulnerability. And then, you know, there are fancier things that you can do to add protection. You could use ballistic glass, drones, counter snipers, surveillance technology. All of those security measures, though, get expensive fast. That is according to Stuart Kaplan. He's a former FBI special agent who now does threat assessments.
Could I anticipate all what ifs? Can I consider the worst case scenarios to get it to the level of my company protecting a sitting United States president? Absolutely. But who would bear the cost?
He says, you know, the level of protection you'd give to a current or former president is more than what Charlie Kirk and others like him could probably afford. And even then, gaps in security can happen. Take last summer in Butler, Pennsylvania. President Trump survived a very close call assassination attempt at a campaign rally. He had many of those layers of protection.
So what can we expect the impact to be from Kirk's assassination when it comes to security?
Right. So I spoke with Jason Russell about that. He was in the Secret Service. He's now a security consultant. He said he wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing, you know, more security at events, metal detectors, things like that, or even public figures holding fewer events or moving them to indoor spaces, which are typically easier to protect. But he said none of that fixes the deeper problem.
You know, obviously, if you pay any attention to social media, it's extremely divisive, and now it's become almost a us versus them mentality.
You know, and research bears that out. Support for political violence is growing among both Democrats and Republicans, and we have seen a string of politically motivated attacks recently. There was the Trump assassination attempt, the arson attack on Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro's home, the murder of a Minnesota lawmaker, and of course, now this killing.
That's NPR's Meg Anderson. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Earlier this month, President Trump ordered a U.S. military strike on a boat in the Caribbean that administration officials suspected of smuggling a drug shipment from Venezuela. Venezuelan officials last week said none of those killed were gang members, but the administration insists the strike, which killed 11 people, was entirely legal. And the strike is dividing lawmakers, including members of Trump's own party. NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales has more.
South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham says the recent U.S. attack on a Venezuelan boat in the Caribbean has shifted the country's rules of engagement.
We're considering narco-terrorist states to be military threats, not law enforcement threats.
The key ally of President Trump says the old days of drug interdiction are gone. Typically, the U.S. Coast Guard intercepts vessels at sea, confiscating illegal drugs and arresting suspects. Graham says the U.S. military strike was different, and it signals it's time for Venezuela to take heed.
This was a boatload full of narco-terrorist gang members that were going to continue to poison America, so I'm okay.
President Trump said illegal drugs and members of the Tren de Aragua criminal gang on board presented an imminent threat. But like many members, Graham says he's also in the dark on exactly who was killed in the September 2nd attack in international waters.
Have you gotten any confirmation that's who was on the boat?
No.
But not everyone agrees. Republican Senator Rand Paul says the strike sets a dangerous precedent for the country. He's worried President Trump will now use force whenever he likes.
Is it going to be the new Coast Guard policy to shoot without asking questions?
That's the Kentucky Republican after a recent series of votes. Now Paul is the loudest GOP critic of the attack that's tested U.S. rules of engagement with its war on drugs.
People need to ask the administration, is there a new policy? Was this a one-off?
Trump has defended the strike by saying the boat was headed for the states.
Venezuela's been very bad, both in terms of drugs and sending some of the worst criminals anywhere in the world into our country.
But that's largely all members know. The administration has yet to share identities of those killed or legal justification for bypassing Congress for the strike. And that's helped fuel questions of whether it violated both domestic and international laws.
It's really an extraordinary expansion of how the United States deals with these kinds of challenges.
That's Yale University law professor Ona Hathaway. She says the strike has an anti-legal nature because the boat's direct threat to the United States is not clear. The Constitution requires Congress to declare war before a strike unless there's an imminent threat where the president can take action.
Does this signal that there are going to be strikes on cartels or supposed drug cartels in Venezuela or in Mexico? Is it setting the stage for something more?
Hathaway says there's no evidence of a careful assessment determining military action was the only choice.
The fact that Congress has just been completely left out of the loop suggests the Trump administration doesn't feel that it has to follow the ordinary rules of the game.
Paul is joining Democrats in demanding more information, but not all Republicans are so concerned. Your Senate Majority Leader, John Thune.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't read too much into it. I think it was a clear interpretation by the cartels. You continue to ship substances up here that are killing Americans. We're going to deal with it as a national security threat.
Still, critics worry that the lack of justification and consultation with Congress could launch the U.S. into a new era of expanded war powers for the president. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, the Capitol.
In communities up and down the shoreline of one of Africa's largest lakes, people have a lot to deal with, from hunger to homelessness. Now, residents say a large oil project in the region is making life even more difficult. Villa Marx has our story.
Joyce Nyandera was born and raised in the Ugandan village of Kabasumbu.
She married there too before becoming a mother and grandmother. Her life, she says, was good.
We were well off. We would care. We would fish. As people who live by the lake is our garden.
But beneath that lake, called Albert, lies 1.4 billion barrels of thick crude oil.
Once oil was discovered, they stopped us from fishing. We started suffering.
Nyandera's home lay right between two planned oil wells, part of a massive project by the Chinese National Offshore Oil Corporation, or CNOOC, one of two global oil giants hoping to extract oil from this region through the East African crude oil pipeline. In May 2019, she was given less than 24 hours to pack up before Ugandan police evacuated her entire village.
There was a soldier standing along each house. A soldier. Beatings. Gunshots. We didn't know why we were evicted.
Nyandera's Congolese husband soon vanished, and she spent a year camping with her children in a nearby school before bravely returning to a flooded, looted home she's had to rebuild. Since then, CNOOC has started constructing those two oil wells very close by.
The noise on its own, our ears are blowing up. When we speak since they started working there, we just shout. You have to speak loud.
The deafening work lit by floodlights often continues round the clock.
We are only staying there because we have nowhere else to go.
In the nearby village of Son Sobi, community health worker Mugisha Kefa helps track illness among villagers. A third oil well and a pipeline were built right in the middle of his community, with loud equipment often passing his home.
Those who have machines, we have generator, and they are producing fumes, which are very harmful in our life.
These fumes get worse in hot weather, he says, alongside dust from dozens of site vehicles that pass daily along unpaved roads. Kefa says the nearest health clinic recently found this seems to be affecting people's health, especially children.
The health workers have been collecting different sputum tests in our community, so it means the rate of coughing is a bit increasing.
Kefa says CNOOC and its contractors told villagers the work sites, which can be as close as 130 feet from some homes, are a safe distance away. Local police checkpoints dot the roads across this region. Foreign journalists are unable to visit the villages and the local health clinics without a special government permit, which was not granted to NPR. CNOOC did not respond to requests for comment. Snaking inland from the lake, yet another major project, a pipeline that will carry the crude oil across Uganda. Locals blame that project for several other new health problems. Hope Alanatwe once grew avocados, mangoes and jackfruit. Most of her compensation money, the pipeline project, ECOP, paid for her land, went towards a motorcycle. She needed it to ferry her severely sick child to hospital once a month for treatment. 3 months after she bought the bike, that child died. Alanatwe now fears for the future of her other kids who are no longer in school. For after ECOP purchased most of her land in 2018, she says she's been unable to farm her small remaining plot successfully. Failing crops and occasional fires were once a nuisance, but with far less land, they can reduce her food production to almost zero.
I am worried. When I think about it, I don't get sleep.
Alanatwe says ECOP had assured locals like her they'd never suffer again, but she says the stress has significantly harmed her health.
I struggle with a hernia. I have had complications. I struggle through the night. I have to find cold water and pour it on myself. If my heart isn't aching, it's the hernia that's burning and leaving me in pain.
ECOP told NPR that national legislation determined land compensation rates reflecting local market values and full replacement costs, and they said residents were not compelled to sign compensation deals. The company also said it was not aware of anyone who's, quote, experienced health problems as a result of project activities. But like others we spoke to, Alanatwe ties her ailment to the nearby oil developments. There's currently little hard data on such health consequences in Uganda, but elsewhere, from Ecuador to Nigeria, such causation has been shown. Maria Leah Ramos at Oxfam works with local communities globally who are affected by large extractive projects like this.
around the world and certainly across Africa, where there are people living near oil facilities, there are negative impacts to public health and to their environment. Air and water pollution, oil spills, gas flaring, contamination of soil and fisheries can lead to respiratory illnesses, skin diseases, cancers, and other chronic conditions.
In a region where many families' survival already hangs by a slim thread, villagers here say these multi-billion dollar oil projects seem to be fraying those threads even more. For NPR News, I'm Bella Marks in Kujumba, Uganda.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Mariachi, the traditional Mexican folk music, is growing in popularity in the United States. In the last decade, at least 10 universities and colleges have started offering degrees in mariachi. The latest is Denver's Metro State University. Colorado Public Radio's Juanita Hurtado Huerfano reports.
Los Correcaminos, Metro State's mariachi ensemble, is practicing Mexico Lindo in a classroom on its Denver campus. Ruby Flores, who is playing guitarrón, joined the ensemble 2 years ago. She learned about them when she signed up for a mariachi class 2 years earlier. She was looking for a place to belong.
I grew up a no sabo kid.
Meaning that she grew up in a Spanish-speaking household, but did not learn the language, something very common in first-generation kids. Her parents immigrated from Mexico.
Being in the United States, my mom really wanted me to be, you know, a United States citizen and, you know, kind of conform to their norms. So the mariachi class was where I tried to reconnect it, and then I instantly fell in love.
Professor Phil Fisher saw in students like Flores an opportunity to expand the program. Mariachi classes and ensembles are becoming more popular in Colorado K-12 schools. They need teachers, and Fisher students are eager to enter the industry.
I took a poll, kind of just a straw poll of my students, and every single hand went up.
He was trying to recruit a student from a city a couple of hours south of Denver.
When I said, hey, we're starting a mariachi degree, his first thing was like, I'm there.
Metro State's degree, launched this year, is called a Bachelor of Arts in Mariachi Performance and Culture. It allows students to dive into the music's history and cultural impact and learn the skills to run their own mariachi businesses. Faculty say the degree will also allow them to charge more for gigs because it proves their experience. They can even earn a teaching certificate.
I want one of our students to graduate and have the ability to say, I want to create my own mariachi ensemble. How do I do that? How do I fill out the paperwork? How do I invoice? How do I do all the things that help a business run?
1, 2, 3.
Professor Fisher takes a lot of pride in the business aspect of the mariachi degree, but he thinks using the program to elevate mariachi's history and cultural impact is what will make a great mariachi musician.
You know, Beethoven once said that music is poetry without words. And in a way, mariachi music is the poetry of the Chicano culture.
The degree is available to all incoming students this fall. For NPR News, I'm Juanita Hurtado Huerfano in Denver.
The 2024 election left the Democratic Party with a lot of soul searching. Party leaders are looking everywhere to answer what went wrong. And some Democrats believe the party has lost ground to Republicans on social media. Their solution? Get more comfortable reaching voters online, even if it means hamming it up in front of the camera.
Not everybody in Congress or the Senate or in government needs to be a TikTok star. But it would be nice if we had a few in our party.
Tune in on your radio. This is NPR News.
You are listening to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE, People Power Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, celebrating 10 years of their German Blonde with a week-long anniversary event, September 30th through October 4th. Includes beer infusions, events, pop-up shops, and live music. Find full details on their Facebook page. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. The Virginia Public Library offers a genealogy assistance program the second Thursday of the month at 4 p.m. Whether you are just starting out or fine-tuning your research, all are welcome. United Way of Northeastern Minnesota is looking for lunch buddy mentors at elementary schools in Aurora, Cherry, Chisholm, Eveleth, Hibbing, Keewatin, Mountain Iron, and Virginia. The deadline to apply is September 26. Find more information at unitedwaynemn.org/volunteer. Now back to Weekend Edition.
I'm Dwahli Saikautau with these headlines. President Trump will travel on Tuesday to the United Kingdom. His three-day visit is set to begin at Windsor Castle, hosted by King Charles III. The British royal family is expected to roll out the red carpet for Trump and his wife, Melania. Romania is now the second NATO ally to detect Russian drones in its airspace near neighbor Ukraine's southern border. F-16 jets were deployed to monitor the incursion, but the drones left without incident. Turning Point USA, the conservative organization that Charlie Kirk co-founded, announced a memorial service for the 31-year-old next Sunday at a stadium in Arizona. I'm Dwahli Saikautau, NPR News in New York City.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru. The 2025 Subaru Outback features symmetrical all-wheel drive plus standard safety features like EyeSight Driver Assist technology. Learn more at Subaru.com/Outback. And from Dignity Memorial. For many families, remembering loved ones means honoring the details that made them unique. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to compassion in every detail of a life celebration. DignityMemorial.com. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe, and it's time to play the puzzle. Joining us this week is Will Shortz. He's puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition. How's it going, Will?
I'm doing great. How are you, Aisha?
I am good. Well, Will, would you please remind us of last week's challenge?
Yes, it came from Joseph Young of St. Cloud, Minnesota. I said, think of a popular commercial name that ends with the names of two male animals, one after the other. And I said, if you have the right one, the first six letters can be rearranged to spell the names of an NFL team. What is it? Well, the name is Instagram, which ends in stag and ram, and the first six letters can be anagrammed into giants.
Well, it seems like this was a tough one for people because there were only 276 correct entries, and this week's winner is Christopher Hoffman of Wellington, Florida. Congratulations, Christopher.
Thank you so much, Aisha. It's such a pleasure to be here.
So how did you figure out this week's answer?
Well, I started writing down all the male animal names I could think of, and then I wrote down all these six-letter NFL teams I could think of, and I thought about it for a while, longer than I'm proud to admit, when my roommate mentioned that he was about to make a post on Instagram, and that's when it clicked in my mind.
Oh my goodness, and you're in college, right?
That is correct. I am a freshman studying physics at the University of Florida.
How long have you been playing the puzzle?
This is my fifth week.
Now, you know, there are people shaking their fists at the radio because they've been playing for 30 years and they haven't won.
Yes, but perhaps I can give hope to the people who are afraid to start because they think it'll take so long.
Yeah, exactly. That is a good point. What do you like to do at school, especially as a freshman? That's a huge transition.
Right. Well, when I'm not doing schoolwork, I really enjoy the outdoors. I love classical music. I'm a classical pianist, and I enjoy all sorts of, well, puzzles and trivia in general, I guess.
So I gotta ask you, Christopher, are you ready to play the puzzle?
Bring it.
Okay. I like that attitude. Take it away, Will.
All right, here you go, Christopher. Every answer today is a famous person whose first or last name is geographical. City, state, country, or otherwise. For example, if I said novelist Jack, you would say London, as in Jack London, who wrote The Call of the Wild. Here's your first one. Actor Joaquin.
Phoenix.
Phoenix is right. Actor Gooding Jr.
Ooh, I don't know this, I don't think.
It's a country where Fidel Castro was the leader.
Cuba? Havana?
Cuba. Cuba Gooding Jr. is correct. Artist O'Keefe.
Georgia.
That's right. Media personality Hilton.
Paris.
That's correct. Composer Irving.
Berlin.
Actress Fanning.
Dakota?
That's correct. Actress Ferreira.
America.
That's right. Adventurer in film Jones.
Indiana.
That's right. Spy in film Powers.
Austin.
Uh-huh. Video game traveler Carmen.
San Diego.
Artist Pollock.
Jackson.
That's it. And your last one is phonetic jazz pianist Chick.
Coria.
That's correct. Nice job.
Thank you.
What a great job. So how do you feel?
This is the greatest phone call of my life. What a joy.
Oh, my goodness.
It's a dream come true. I get to be on NPR and I get to talk to my idol, Will Shortz. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
That is wonderful. For playing our puzzle today, you'll get a weekend edition lapel pin as well as puzzle books and games. You can read all about it at npr.org/puzzle. And Christopher, what member station do you listen to?
WLRN Miami.
That's Christopher Hoffman of Wellington, Florida. Thanks so much for playing the puzzle.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, Will, what's next week's challenge?
Yes, it comes from Bob Weiss. In a certain classic film, the protagonist uses two weapons. The name of one of these has 10 letters, and if you take its first letter and last six letters, you can rearrange them to spell the name of another weapon this protagonist uses in seven letters. What weapons are these? So again, it's a classic film. Everyone knows it. And the protagonist uses two weapons. The name of one of these has 10 letters. Take the first letter and the last six letters, and you can rearrange them all to name the other weapon this protagonist uses in seven letters. What weapons are these?
You have your assignment, puzzlers. When you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle, to submit your response. Just fill out the form on the puzzle page. Remember, just one entry, please. Our deadline for entries this week is Thursday, September 18th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Don't forget to include a phone number where we can reach you. If you're the winner, we'll give you a call. And if you pick up the phone, you'll get to play on the air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition, Will Shortz. Thank you, Will.
Thanks, Asia.
In the summer of 1985, a couple of kids kick over a barrel in the woods near Bear Brook State Park in New Hampshire. That barrel and a second one nearby contained the remains of one woman and three children. After their discovery, the identities of the Bear Brook murder victims remained a mystery for decades.
And finally, in 2019, we learned the identities of three of the four Bear Brook victims. Marlise Honeychurch and her two children, Marie Vaughn and Sarah McWaters.
Jason Moon is a reporter at New Hampshire Public Radio and host of the true crime podcast about the case Bear Brook.
But that left one more, one last victim, whose name we never learned. The one investigators often called the middle child. Another little girl, estimated to be just 3 years old when she was killed. Who was she?
This past week, Bear Brook released a new episode. Update, it said, the last remaining Bear Brook victim is identified. Jason Moon joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
For those who haven't listened to the podcast, I want to take a step back because this case spans 40 years. Can you give a brief background?
Yeah, you know, really the story for a long time was that we just didn't know who these people were. And then about 10 years ago, there started to be some breaks in the case, thanks to what was then a novel investigative technique called genetic genealogy. This is an investigative technique that relies on genealogical websites that people might recognize, like Ancestry.com or, I guess, formerly 23andMe, where you can send in a DNA sample and have it compared to other people, and you can find relatives that maybe you didn't know you had. Investigators realized they could use that same technique to identify human remains. By 2019, we knew, thanks to that technique, three of the Bear Brook victims' names and also the name of the man who police believe was responsible for their murders, Terry Peter Rasmussen. He died in prison in 2010 before this discovery was made. But that left one victim who was still unidentified, a little girl about 3 years old when she was killed, who for a long time investigators just referred to as the middle child.
So who was the middle child and why was she so difficult to identify?
We recently learned that her name was Rhea Rasmussen. For a long time, all we knew about her was that she was a biological daughter to Terry Rasmussen. You know, what made it so hard to identify her? Part of it was just luck. When you put DNA samples into these online DNA databases, you don't know if you're going to get a match that's your brother or like a fifth cousin. And obviously, the more distant the relatives, the harder it is to make an identification. A group called the DNA Doe Project spent, you know, hundreds of hours building a family tree that included more than 25,000 people. And they ultimately were able to find her mother, a woman named Pepper Reed. From there, they were able to find a birth certificate with Rhea's name on it. And it listed as the father, Terry Peter Rasmussen.
This show clearly struck a nerve for listeners. Bear Brook has been downloaded more than 20 million times. Stephen King is a fan, but New Hampshire Public Radio is set to lose about 6% of its annual budget after the vote in Congress to defund public broadcasting. How will that affect the work you do, especially when it comes to stories like this one?
Public media has turned out to be one of the more stable business models, and it's allowed local journalists to make a living and make a career out of this type of work, and that allows someone to spend 10 years following a story. I would hate to see that kind of stability and longevity that public media can offer communities threatened, and of course, you know, we're trying to do everything we can to make sure it doesn't, but the loss of federal funding is hard on stations like us, as I know it is even harder for many other stations around the country.
At the end of the latest episode, you wonder out loud, why spend all this time? Why go to all the effort just to find a name, just two words, as you say? Do you feel like you got an answer?
Yeah, I talked with this investigator with the DNA Doe Project who led the team. And we talked about what it meant to know her name was Rhea Rasmussen. A name can help us recognize a person's humanity and sort of grant them personhood so that they don't have to remain unidentified victim or Bear Brook Jane Doe or the middle child. And I think for so many of the people who worked on this case, that felt worth it to them.
That's Jason Moon. He's a reporter and producer at New Hampshire Public Radio and host of the podcast Bear Brook. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Television's annual celebration of itself airs tonight. That would be the Emmy Awards. But this morning, we're giving out a different set of prizes. Each year, NPR's critic at large, Eric Deggans, brings us his picks for what really deserves TV's highest honor, and we call those winners the Deggies. Eric is here with me now to unveil the winners. Hey, Eric.
Hey, I'm so honored to present an award show named after me.
Yes,
it's awesome.
It is awesome. Well, first off, for those who may not know, how do the Deggies actually work?
Well, the coolest thing about the rules for this is that there aren't really rules. I just like to highlight shows and performances that I think the TV Academy might overlook or get wrong. I looked over their nominations. I tossed in a little snark, my own critical observations, and voila, you have a Deggie Award. For example, in the category of best drama, you know, critics say series like Apple TV Plus's Severance or HBO's The White Lotus are the big favorites.
Okay, but your first Deggie goes to
Andor, the ambitious Disney Plus series that's also the prequel for maybe the most misunderstood Star Wars movie ever, Rogue One. Now, science fiction series rarely land in the winner's circle at the Emmys for major categories, and I kind of expect that to continue this year. But in addition to giving us one of the most meticulously crafted dramas of the year, Andor made its mark by charting this terrifying, violent, ruthless way that a rebellion comes to life against an oppressive authoritarian regime, which kind of feels like a story of our times.
But who is actually going to win Best Drama tonight at the Emmys?
Well, my money's on The White Lotus, even though Severance is a great contender, and it's the one I would pick if I were voting. I mean, I love Ben Stiller's ambitiously weird vision for Severance, but I think there's a lot of celebrity buzz around HBO's The White Lotus, and it's always tough to know how many people actually even see these Apple TV Plus shows like Severance even now.
Okay, now let's talk about comedy. So lots of shows that people love are nominated, including Hacks on HBO Max and The Studio on Apple TV Plus. But your Deggie goes to
The Residence on Netflix.
But that wasn't even nominated for an Emmy this year, was it? And it wasn't renewed, right?
No, it wasn't. But these are my rules. I can do what I want. I mean, The Residence is this delightfully bonkers take on the investigation into a bizarre murder at the White House involving the building's even more bizarre staff. You're right. It wasn't nominated. Netflix canceled the show. But star Uzo Aduba is nominated for playing the brilliant birder slash investigator Cordelia Cupp. Still, it managed this feat of outlining how the White House housekeepers, custodians, cooks, and assorted building staff actually work together. Wrapping up that tale in this gigantic parody of a whodunit that's just really cool.
Well, since The Residence isn't actually in the running, though, who will win tonight?
Okay, so this is an interesting category because FX is The Bear, which won a ton of Emmys last year and once was a huge favorite, seems to have faced some backlash recently. So I think the real contest is between HBO Max's Hacks, which won Best Comedy last year, and Apple TV Plus's The Studio, which has two things that Hollywood loves, Seth Rogen and the chance to pretend the industry has a sense of humor about itself. So my choice is The Studio, which is the shiny new series with Hacks as the dark horse.
Now, one category many people will be watching for tonight will be Outstanding Talk Series, because Stephen Colbert's Late Show is nominated and CBS recently announced that the show would be canceled in May. So does he deserve a Deggie?
For sure. I mean, this show is still tossing zingers, even in its 10th year. And even though CBS owner Paramount may argue that the show was losing money, I'm always going to believe that Colbert's cancellation was, in part, a political decision that corporate leaders were too chicken to admit. Now, I think The Daily Show might actually win here because it's always incisive and relevant. But it would be nice if Colbert collected an honor for continuing to speak truth to power.
That's NPR's critic at large, Eric Deggans, with his annual Deggie TV Awards. The Emmy Awards air tonight on CBS. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you.
Now, do you send out the Deggies to the show winners? Do you?
They could care less.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at Viking.com. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from the Watermark Arts Center in downtown Bemidji with exhibits, classes, and handcrafted original art made by regional artists found in their shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public. WatermarkArtsCenter.org. Ripple River Gallery, south of Deerwood, hosts the dual exhibit Reclaim Reframed, now through September 28th, featuring sculptures from KAXE's own John Bauer, paired with photographs from Rachel Kane. The exhibit proves that one person's trash is another person's treasure. Open Wednesday through Saturday from 10 to 5 and Sunday 11 to 4. And the KAXE Newsroom has created a map of northern Minnesota's farmers markets throughout our region, from places like Park Rapids to Palo and Black Duck to Crosby. Most markets run through September or October. Find the map at KAXE.org. Now we'll take you back to Morning Edition.